Welcome to another exciting episode of Deterrence Down Under, a podcast dedicated to Australia and the challenges of deterrence in the Indo-Pacific region. Deterrence Down Under is part of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies podcasting network, where we strive to promote peace, foster strategic stability, and help you to think deterrence. Just a friendly reminder that the opinions expressed by our hosts and guests are their own and don't necessarily reflect any institution with which they may be affiliated. G'day from Canberra. We hope you enjoyed the show. Hi there, I'm Dr. Carl Rhodes.
Hey, I'm Christine Leo.
And I'm Natalie Trelaw.
And we want to welcome you to another episode of Deterrence Down Under. Now its own podcast. We've got our own little title and everything, so we're excited about that. And today we're really lucky. We're going to be talking about Pakistan's approach to deterrence, and we have a leading expert with us, Ms. Anum Khan. And Anum is an associate director at the Center for International Strategic Studies in Islamabad, and also a research fellow at the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization, or CTBTO, for those who can't string all those words together almost as well as I could. She's also a project associate on a European Research Council-funded project at the University of Leicester titled Towards a Third Nuclear Age, Strategic Conventional Weapons, and the Next Revolution in the Global Nuclear Order. So her areas of expertise encompass a broad range of topics. I could probably spend a third of the podcast talking through all of them, but today we're just going to tap on a few of them, including deterrence, strategic stability, nuclear export controls, nonproliferation, and arms control and disarmament. So before we jump into that discussion, just a couple pieces of deterrence-related news from Australia related to AUKUS specifically. So Defence here in Australia has announced it will invest a further $262 million Australian dollars to support the uplift of Australian industry and help it participate in the AUKUS supply chain. So the funding is supposed to flow through to about 125 countries or companies across the nation that are working in a range of areas. It's going to help them support and upgrade and enhance their processes to help contribute to global supply chains, specifically, maybe not global, but US and UK supply chains, I should say. But we can also compare this to the roughly $9 billion that Australia has invested into increasing the capacity of U.S. and U.K. industry to produce these nuclear subs at the same time. So lots of investment there to help get the conventionally armed nuclear-powered subs. Secondly is they're starting to work on the draft strategic impact assessment report for the planned nuclear-powered submarine construction yard in Osborne, South Australia. Those will be really where the rubber hits the road, where we find out, you know, what local communities think about having nuclear-powered subs constructed in their neighborhood. Public consultation is going to happen over roughly the next month, out till 17th of March. And we'll provide an opportunity for people to review the report and share their feedback. So all this is about Australia getting the conventionally armed nuclear power subs. There's also a great deal of interest for Pakistan in submarines and for other nations in the region too. But Pakistan specifically is reported to have interest in acquiring Chinese submarines to host either sub-launch nuclear armed ballistic missiles or you know, tactical nuclear weapons. I've heard some different reports on that, and so we'll probably get into that as part of the discussion. But Anum, first, just for you, you know, how does Pakistan approach deterrence? Because we here in Australia, you know, we don't know as much about Pakistan as we should. So maybe you can just give us a 101 to how Pakistan thinks about deterrence and what are the drivers behind its nuclear weapons.
Thank you for having me. First of all, I would say that historically, Pakistan started its nuclear program in 1950s for just peaceful purposes through Atoms for Peace. And then later, Pakistan even was a founding member of the IAEA, and Pakistan had no intention whatsoever to develop nuclear weapons. But in 1974, after India diverged the Canadian supplied fuel for nuclear testing, that was when Pakistan felt an existential threat from its adversary. Even after that, at first, Pakistan proposed a nuclear weapons-free zone in South Asia time and again, which was turned down by India. And even in 1998, later, when India tested nuclear weapons, Pakistan was compelled to safeguard its sovereignty and security, and thus tested the weapons itself as well. And we need to understand the broader perspective of Pakistan's deterrence, that Pakistan's nuclear weapons are only and solely India-centric. Pakistan's nuclear arsenal is part of an effort to deny India any kind of space for launching any kind of aggression against Pakistan. There have been certain drivers of all of this, because Pakistan thinks that India still has a first strike option, and India has opted for counter-force temptations as well as massive retaliation. With that, Pakistan also has experienced that India seeks space for war under nuclear overhang. So this is kind of a risky behavior where this region, South Asia, is already considered as a nuclear hotspot.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. And I would imagine the short timelines associated with, you know, being land bordered, you know, nations thinking about deterring each other, that must make a real challenge for deterrence and the timelines and command and control. So, you know, how does Pakistan approach that really difficult challenge of having to respond within single digit minutes potentially for some of these attacks?
You see, it's a really pertinent question, because the response time is even less than 4 minutes. So what Pakistan needs to do is, to deter India, Pakistan has to have a credible nuclear triad, and it maintains a policy of credible minimum deterrence. And even if Pakistan has a policy of full spectrum deterrence, that is also in line with or under the dictates of the credible, being minimum, while deterring India. And Pakistan is a minimalist nuclear power. And in that sense, the idea is that there should not be any conflict that could escalate to total war, because then there are no winners in nuclear war. So all Pakistan wants to do is deter India.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And I would imagine conventional forces are also part of that deterrence, right? So you need to maintain the conventional balance of forces, the nuclear balance of forces, to have a credible second strike. You know, how does Pakistan think about that in terms of modernization? And let's just talk about the nuclear side. I mean, the conventional side, there's obviously a lot of alleys we could run down. But, you know, in terms of nuclear modernization, what is Pakistan looking at to help ensure that credible response, that credible second strike?
In 2011, interestingly, Pakistan opted for a Naval Strategic Force Command, because Pakistan needs a credible, second strike capability. Right now, Pakistan does not have an assured second strike capability because we don't have those nuclear submarines. But overall, we have these dictates of our nuclear doctrine, which devises our strategy and our deployment and all these things. The thing is that Pakistan's nuclear weapons are meant for deterrence. Secondly, there's this centralized national nuclear command and control. And the national command authority is chaired by the prime minister. Pakistan, although does not subscribe to NFU, but Pakistan has this non-aggression pact. Overall, to avoid, because the response time is so small, Pakistan has a policy of war avoidance and not at all war fighting. At the same time, Pakistan gives negative security assurances to non-nuclear weapon states. Pakistan also has a principled position on disarmament. However, Pakistan has to have a certain number of nuclear weapons. Obviously, none of the country's nuclear weapons are, you know, open. There's no data available in open source. But we can also say that Pakistan's fissile material production, delivery systems, they are all well thought out, and they are only to deter one adversary. For example, if we look at the ranges of Pakistani nuclear missiles, the Shaheen 3 missile is of the range of 2,750. Why so specific? It is so that Indian outland different islands like Andaman Island and Nicobar Island can be also covered. So what Pakistan wants to do is to just cover the entirety of India, so that India does not opt for any kind of attack against Pakistan, which would result in an unacceptable damage to India.
Anum, how, as the strategic landscape is changing with time, and we're sort of playing this, seeing this play out in real time now currently, I mean, historically, there's always been relationship, well, there's been, Pakistan's had relations with China historically, where you've had your strategic cooperation, and it's grown over the past few decades with consultative mechanisms, defence cooperation, trade and investment, and the China-Pakistan economic corridor. And we've seen the Indo-Russian strategic partnership that's been built on the five major components of politics, defence, civil, nuclear energy, anti-terrorism, and cooperation, as well as the advancement of exploration in outer space. As we're seeing these relations develop between China and Russia, and then we've also got the other relations with North Korea and Iran obviously sitting in the background there, how is Pakistan thinking about these issues in future, even though you're saying that they're only developed for one adversary, and I can see how that can be true, but what is Pakistan sort of thinking about in that future piece? And you're also working on a piece, aren't you, about the third nuclear age too? So would you be able to sort of talk us through that, please?
Yes, please. That is a really good and deep question. Why? Because, see, Pakistan's geostrategic location is a blessing as well as a curse. We are surrounded by nuclear neighbors. Then we have Iran, which also wants to go nuclear at one point in time, maybe in the future. But if we take it one by one, with China, Pakistan has had very deep relations since the start. Pakistan was the first country to recognize China as a state. And we should also remember that in the past, Pakistan also played a mediatory role kind of connect both US and China at the start as well. China has always been there for Pakistan. However, militarily, even there was this India-China conflict, Pakistan stayed at bay, because militarily, Pakistan does not want to get involved into anybody else's conflict. And also, if we look at Iran, interestingly, Iran is one of those neighbors with which Pakistan has had no bigger territorial dispute or any kind of dispute whatsoever. It is just some border issues which need to be politically resolved. So Pakistan does not have any other threat coming from anywhere right now. One cannot say anything about the future, but Pakistan has tried to make sure that Pakistan is aligned with major powers in a way that it does not really have to choose sides. But at the same time, the U.S. policies and have dictated Pakistan's foreign policy trajectory. For example, at the start, in the past, Russia wanted to have good relations with Pakistan, and so did Pakistan. But Pakistan's relationship with Russia was dictated by China, because at the start, Pakistan was also part of CETO and Central Alliance. And Pakistan expected that in 1971 war, US would come and aid Pakistan in some way, but that did not happen. That also created a sort of trust deficit. And when US needed Pakistan in Afghanistan to create stability in Afghanistan, US was there with Pakistan. Pakistan back then was considered as the major non-NATO ally. But now definitely the policies are being shifted by the major players, especially the US, and they're now looking towards India for their own valid reasons. For example, they want to make India bulwark against China. That is a separate story. That would India fight the US war with China if push comes to shove? Because we have had some US scholars from really important places in the US who visited us at our center, and we had this discussion, and they said that US political elite and US military and everybody, they do understand that India is not going to fight the US war with China, but we're still doing it because there's this military nuclear industrial complex at play. So overall, Pakistan is in a very difficult geostrategic, Pakistan has a very difficult geostrategic neighborhood. And the thing is that major powers expect Pakistan to do something just because they said so. But Pakistan has to, first of all, look at its national security interests. For example, Pakistan did not want to opt for nuclear weapons at the start because we know it is a very difficult business and it would be very tough on our economy, on our political side and everything, because Pakistan just, you know, was a very nascent power, and Pakistan needed international support. And we still got, in 1980s, we got that Presser Amendment, we got all those sanctions in the past, even when Pakistan had not really shown that indication that Pakistan wants to offer nuclear weapons. But now, even today, you see the same case, that whensoever there's this new US administration, it is always said that Pakistan has to do more. Pakistan, I think, has done enough. And now it is time for Pakistan to think for itself, because, you know, sovereignty and national interest come first.
Anam, these are marvelous points. And I hope not to come off as biased, but I, as we were discussing previously, I had the immense privilege and honor of my life to come and work and live in Islamabad and to understand Pakistani strategic culture, thinking about nuclear weapons and so forth. Because at least my experience at the time until then had been, you know, Pakistan is a rogue or slash terrorist state. And I'm like, you know what? They've invited me to come and live with them. I'm just going to go and see for myself. And again, I hope not to come across as biased, but like having lived there and lived with people of a very different culture to mine, I think that there is a lot of bias, or at least there was a lot of bias, at least in the 90s, you know, when India and Pakistan detonated their first bombs. Oh, it's the Hindu bomb, it's the Islamic bomb. It's like, oh, well, is that a useful way of thinking about things? I'm not sure. But Pakistan, I think, in general, is a misunderstood country in general, but especially regarding nuclear deterrence. And I've just been thinking about the history and the you know, thinking about what could characterize the future of nuclear strategy. I'm just wondering, there's this very interesting article that came out in Reuters about Pakistan potentially expanding its nuclear arsenal, but, you know, this against the backdrop of China also purportedly expanding its arsenal. And I'm just interested, from an Australian perspective, if it was possible to make the link between South Asia proliferation and deterrence dynamics and broader Asia Pacific and Australian interests in deterrence dynamics in the region, like, you know, sorry, I'll stop ranting. But, you know, countries such as India and Pakistan and France and Great Britain have had smaller arsenals compared to the, you know, the superpowers, quote unquote, United States, America, Soviet Union, now China, PRC, whatever. I'm interested in your thoughts about, you know, sort of why do some countries start off with minimalist deterrence postures, or how do they evolve to become more maximalist deterrence owners, such as the United States, you know, where we have this full spectrum deterrence, sort of like escalation, dominance, control. Anyway, I'll shut up now, but I'm interested in your views on the possible evolution in the next, I don't know, 30 years of Pakistani deterrence thinking around strategic and other deterrence.
As I said earlier, that Pakistan's perspective on nuclear issues is based only on what India does. So we need to understand the fact that Pakistan has, since the start till the end, always remained a minimalist power, no matter what the misperceptions have been regarding Pakistan having the fastest growing nuclear program and all that. There was this study I would urge you all to read, and if you guys don't have that book, I'll send it to you. It's about Indian assessment of its nuclear program, the Indian unsafeguarded nuclear program, in which there were these independent researchers who took all the Indian data that was available in open source and came to a conclusion that it is India that is the fastest growing nuclear program. For example, even in the Harvard study, it was mentioned that there are three different streams of Indian nuclear program, where they have this safeguarded program, then this unsafeguarded, and then there's one civilian unsafeguarded program. So what it does is the more nuclear deals that India has and the more nuclear material that India imports, that leaves more of its domestic material to be used for military purposes. So here, even you see Pakistan does not get access to nuclear trade or anything except in civil nuclear, that too from China. And the thing is, Pakistan cannot afford to go at that maximum level of attaining so many nuclear weapons. Pakistan requires just enough plus one to counter India. So it has never been, and even just because we know that is going to, in the future, pressurize our economy a lot, because Indian defense program is huge, and Pakistan's defense budget is not even one by eighth, I guess, than that of India. So what Pakistan has opted as a solution is that to counter the threat, Pakistan has opted for not quantitatively, but qualitatively enhancing its nuclear deterrence. For example, India opted for a ballistic missile defense system. India is acquiring that S-400 from Russia and through US and Israel. India is working on that. If it was going into an arms race, Pakistan would have said so. If India has it, we'll have it. Pakistan thinks that there's no need of a ballistic missile defense system for Pakistan. So we're not going on that trajectory, which is even, which gives you a false sense of security, and you are investing so much money into that. So there is, every state is a rational model. If you go by that rational theory, then Pakistan has opted to not to go into an arms race with India. At the same time, time and again, Pakistan has proposed a strategic restraint regime to India, which also encompasses conventional deterrence, not just nuclear, because you see Pakistan went nuclear because there was this huge conventional asymmetry vis-a-vis India. We fought so many wars, we had so many skirmishes, and we had so many border disputes. India also illegally occupied that Kashmir region. So Pakistan has had a lot of bones of contention with India. At the same time, the Indian government, especially under Modi, is opting for this Akhand Bharat. I don't know if you guys know this or not, but India has displayed, it's all about the optics. India has displayed Akhand Bharat map in its parliament. And that means in that map, India, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, everything is India. So Pakistan thinks that India does not want Pakistan to even exist. We have these grievances since the independence, since 1947. But the sad part is, just because India obviously is opting for a blue water navy in the future, these are well-documented sources, Indian officials saying it. India wants to be a regional player, global player. India wants to have a seat on the table, maybe UNSC Security Council, maybe export control regimes, which India is part of, except the nuclear supplies group. So India is not ready, because of all that, all those ambitions that India has, to sit on the table and talk to Pakistan about, okay, this is our nuclear weapons, these are your nuclear weapons, let's talk, let's set a boundary, because we need to understand that there are no winners or losers in nuclear war. Everybody is a loser. So that is the case.
Anam, would you be able to talk us through how effective the nuclear weapons have been in the background of these skirmishes that we've seen on the border? Because I've only sort of had the experience of reading it through my research and making my own assessment of that. So I'd really love to hear it from your perspective as to how effective they've been at keeping that limited.
There is this stability-instability paradox, obviously, that on the higher level, there is no war going on. But on the lower level, there are certain conflicts and certain skirmishes. These LOC violations and skirmishes are a part of routine, although there have been these agreements between India and Pakistan that we are not going to, opt for any adventurism vis-a-vis each other. But still, we saw this Pulwama and Balakot crisis. I think there were different eras. For example, before 1998, when Pakistan did not have a nuclear capability, but there was this general thought that maybe Pakistan is going to go towards it or developing it. Then there was this concept of bomb in the basement, where India was still deterred to not to go and, cross that nuclear threshold, because they were still worried that Pakistan somehow is going to inflict unacceptable damage. At the same time, there was this 2001-2002 border standoff, there was this Mumbai crisis, then there were other crises that happened. The good thing was that all these crises did not opt or go towards total war, or nuclear weapons were not used. Why did that happen? It's all well documented. I may seem biased because I'm a Pakistani, but I'm here to give a Pakistani perspective. Pakistan showed a very restrained response to all those provocations in the past. Pakistan, when there was this alleged terrorist attack anywhere in India, Pakistan opted and requested for a joint probe in those attacks, which later are also documented officially that their own officials were involved in those attacks. So before going on to investigate, India has always opted to blame Pakistan if something happened in India straight away. So we also remember that India opted for surgical strikes against, so-called surgical strikes against Pakistan, and Pakistan showed a restrained response. And after that, Pakistan now has opted for a quid pro plus policy. What is that? It is, some people confuse it with the nuclear policy, even in Pakistani circles. Some experts do that. But let me clear that. The quid pro quo plus policy is a conventional response to any of Indian aggression on the on Pakistan. And first it was quid pro quo, but India did not learn this lesson. Now it has been termed by General Kidwai as quid pro quo plus. That whatsoever that you do to us, we'll do the same to you, but one step more. So you are going to have more damage. So overall, there has been no incident where nuclear weapons have been used. Even in 2023, there was this BrahMos missile crisis where Indian BrahMos missile, which is nuclear capable as well, had been accidentally or intentionally launched to check Pakistan's maybe air defense and landed in Pakistan. Even back then, the response time is so small, not much can be done about it. So, but lesson needs to be learned that, if there is a weapon launched anywhere from Pakistan or India, nobody is going to be able to stop it. So that is why deterrence always has played its role during all these crises.
Mutually assured destruction. For sure.
Mutually assured. Yeah,
exactly. I was going to ask, in terms of communications, given that, we had some, the missile firing, whether it be deliberate or accident, given that there are extremist groups and terrorists that are wanting to light a spark in this conflict, how do the governments communicate with each other? Is there any equivalent of the Cold War red phone that was sitting on the president's desk, supposedly the U.S. could call, the Soviet Union at the time? Is there something similar to that here, or is it signaling and messaging through other means?
Yes, that is a really good point. Despite the fact that this relationship is extremely adversarial, there have been a number of CBMs that have been at play between India and Pakistan. The first one was in 1998, which was about the agreement for prohibition of attack against nuclear installations and facilities. And then in 2005, there was this agreement for pre-notification of flight testing of ballistic missiles. And then later in 2007, there was this agreement for the, reducing the risk for accidents related to nuclear weapons. Then again, there are these hotlines between Pakistan and India, which are there to cater for such measures. So, you know, sanity has prevailed at some point, but, you know, a lot needs to be done. I personally think, yes, these agreements are there. They are at play. But, for example, about missile testing, even cruise missiles or submarine launched cruise missiles should also be part of those. And see, there are now emerging technologies coming into play. The threat is changing. The warfare is changing. So we need to sit on the table and talk and, you know, work on more CBMs. At least on Pakistani side, as an expert in the field, there have been a number of occasions where I have proposed so many confidence-building measures, may it be cyber CBMs, may it be CBMs related to artificial intelligence and nuclear nexus, or may it be other, you know, improvement of nuclear traditional CBMs. I proposed them, and I'm sure Pakistan must have done its homework, but whensoever India is ready to sit and talk, we will have many proposals on the table.
That's good. That's really good. Any last thoughts in terms of concerns for the future, things that we should be watching for here from Australia? You know, any last things that we should take away from this that you'd like to leave us with?
The major important thing is that obviously your national interest comes first for every country, even if you may be part of some extended deterrence. For example, there are countries which are under the US nuclear umbrella, but you never know that in the future would US risk, you know, the other territory for its own territory. So, you know, look out for yourselves, one thing. Two, the idea of this white man's burden that, oh, I can have these weapons, but you cannot. And if you have those weapons, then that is an Islamic bomb or a Christian bomb, or the way Christine already mentioned, that is outright wrong. Because, you know, nuclear weapons are only and mostly, you know, earlier, yes, major powers did opt for nuclear weapons for prestige, and even India did so. But, you know, countries like Pakistan, they opted for weapons for security concerns only, not even for domestic politics. So that is one thing that is very important. Also, it is very important to sit on the table and talk to your adversary. Dialogue is the way. And see the kind of relationship Russia has with US. But in the past, they did sit on the table. They had, I have no comments for today or in the future, but they did have New START. They did have INF Treaty and all these arms control agreements. And also, one thing that I would like to add here is that the idea of nuclear exceptionalism, where some states are given a priority for their, for whatsoever reasons, for political gains or whatsoever reasons they may be, the major powers need to understand that kind of disrupts the stability of that region. And that kind of creates more dangers for the world. It's not just dangerous for South Asia if India uses a nuclear weapon. That would be, you know, if a nuclear weapon is used in this region, the effects would be beyond that. So I think that is really important. So the major powers need to, invest in the way they have added India into different export control regimes. I think those regimes can be used to coerce into getting something at least back as a quid pro quo. They need to tell India that this is not the behavior which should be acceptable in international arena. You need to sit and talk so that the effects are never, you know, felt of a nuclear war in South Asia.
Ah, very good. I think Christine has a last point that she wants to make from our side, maybe.
Yeah, cheers, Carl. Thank you. Like I said, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on to our humble show. I really think that South Asian voices in particular have not been heard enough. I know there are efforts such as the Stimson Foundation and so forth, but the Pakistani voices are not ones that are typically heard in the Asia-Pacific space more broadly. Thank you for your commentary. And it's really interesting, you know, I'll shut up briefly. but it was interesting, you know, in 2008, you had people in the US saying, oh, well, we'll sign a deal, nuclear suppliers group with India because it's a quote unquote responsible nuclear power. And I remember roughly around the same time, and then a few years later, I came to work in Pakistan. You know, well, what is a responsible nuclear weapon state, and what does that mean? And, you know, India's done all these things, okay, but Pakistan has also done all these things. So why is there kind of like a second rating system? But it's interesting. I think you know, again, broadly speaking, in the grand scheme of history. Again, I like to say the nuclear age is very young in military history, and it's easy to judge countries that have traditionally had smaller nuclear arsenals compared to the United States and the Soviet Union, you know, such as France, Great Britain, India, Pakistan, Israel, and so forth. But, like, it will be interesting, I think, to see, you know, because Pakistan and India haven't been as accepted as nuclear weapon states because they didn't ratify the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty at a certain date. We'll say, well, that's a treaty at a certain date. So, like, you know, what makes a responsible nuclear weapon state? Is it just a timely thing? I don't know. But it will be interesting, again, we can talk about this in a future episode, what might be the drivers of countries such as India and Pakistan have had traditionally small nuclear arsenals expanding or modernizing their arsenals beyond what they've traditionally been thought of as, you know, and to what extent does arsenal size imply doctrine, you know, like minimal deterrence versus like a American model, which is much more maximalist, you know, flexible response, cover the maximum amount of targets, etc. But I think it will be really interesting. And as you know, it's kind of our turn in the Asia Pacific to get some attention in strategic studies, rightly or wrongly. It'll be really interesting to see how, you know, the Indian thinking, the Pakistani thinking about nuclear weapons and doctrine evolves. And I think it's really interesting and has really big implications for countries like Australia, which have not, again, traditionally had to think very seriously about these topics for quite some time.
May I add a point here?
For sure.
Okay. So the thing is, we took those Cold War concepts and applied them in South Asia. The thing is that we need to decolonize this subject altogether. We need to also understand for example, KNW's tactical nuclear weapons have a different idea. And you also wrote about it, they have a different idea for US and Russia dynamics. They would have a different idea when it comes to Pakistan and India, because we would always have this centralized command and control, because KNWs would be on the land and we can always control, you know, who decides. So similarly, if you look at the responsible state, you know, we always talk about, you know, Pakistan is not a responsible nuclear weapon state, or this state or that state is not a nuclear responsible nuclear weapon state. You know, what actually devises a responsible nuclear weapon state? If you look at Pakistan's nuclear security regime, it is based on a national legislature. We have proper regulatory framework. We have this administrative framework. We know about, you know, I've already talked about national command authority. Pakistan also has a multi-layer defense system, and there's a proper security force of at least 30,000 personnel who is dedicated for protecting nuclear installations and weapons. And then there's this personal reliability program for officials who are dealing directly with nuclear weapons, and they are routinely vetted after, you know, months, a few months every time. No country has such a robust security plan in place like Pakistan, and, you know, even U.S. officials at time and again had always been, you know, proponents of the fact that Pakistan has a top-notch nuclear safety and security, and nuclear security is a national responsibility, and Pakistan is very confident but not complacent. And also, when it comes to the idea of different senators, somebody coming on the stage and saying, different officials saying that Pakistan is going to attack US. You know, we were talking about that earlier as well, before this podcast, you know, a few days back. It's just that Pakistan's range is only subject to India. Yes, maybe in the future when India has these submarines patrolling, which may be beyond 2750, then Pakistan may opt to increase the range. And also, if Pakistan wants to reach the US, Pakistan would need at least 13,000 range kilometers range, and that is not there. It's technically not possible. And we're not even talking about the fact that Pakistan does not consider US as a threat at all, despite the fact that in different national security strategies, you know, the presidents have time and again turned Pakistan as an epicenter of terrorism without realizing that it was US war on terror, which Pakistan fought and lost more than 80 to 90,000 civilians as well as military personnel. We have given so much and we're still asked to do more. So it is very important to understand when to put your foot down, because there are no friends and foes in international politics. If something happens in Pakistan, we know that China wouldn't come save us, US wouldn't come save us. We have to take care of our sovereignty and national interests first, and that is what we have been doing. And thank you.
Nah. Thank you very much. Really good discussion there on, you know, having nuclear weapons does not make you a nuclear power. There's a lot of infrastructure and thinking and security and all that that goes behind it for being a responsible nuclear power, for sure. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, those of us in Australia and those in the United States as well at times forget is Pakistan and India have a very complex history. It's not, you know, painted as, oh, they'll be an ally or they'll be an adversary in these, you know, various conflicts. You know, they clearly have their own interests and, you know, have their own goals in the global geostrategic competition. So really, thank you very much. That's all we have time for today, but I really want to thank you very much for joining us today. It was great. A really good discussion on Pakistan, deterrence challenges, and some of the challenges being faced there in South Asia to help us learn more here on Deterrence Down Under. Thanks for our listeners for listening, and remember to always think deterrence. Thank you for listening to Deterrence Down Under. Please take a minute to review the podcast, as your reviews help our podcast reach more listeners and expand the debate about strategic issues facing Australia and the region. Our show is made possible by the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization that relies upon donations to produce this podcast and spread awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can find a wide range of NIDS podcasts at thinkdeterrence.com. If you have any questions or feedback, feel free to send us an email at ddu@thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, and our sponsors, and all the amazing members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible.